Well, thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I hope I can make sense out of this. I give some of the results for you anyway. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about energy scales in high temperature superconductors. So I suppose it's of interest to you if you're going to look at quantum criticality. So this work is mostly by my students, Utpal, postdocs, and our collaborators, and we depend very strongly on Mike and Mohit to give us a lot of input, not on any models, but on trying to understand the data new ways. So here's a picture of the cast of characters, as you can see. And we're very lucky to collaborate also with people from Tohoku University, Takahashi and his group. And we get samples from Hélène Raffi in France and Katsuo Kadowaki in Japan. Okay, so this is a brief outline of what I'm going to tell you about. So first I'm going to tell you about the phase diagram. From our point of view, from the ARCUS point of view, it's not really a thermodynamic phase diagram, but what we see. And so that means, what are these different phases that I'm talking about? And how does the spectral function behave in these different phases? And then about the anisotropy of the spectral function as a function of momentum and energy. Okay, so let's first talk about ARCUS. I suppose most of you know in great detail, but I'll just tell you what I'm going to discuss in particular. So this is the spectrum that we measure. So this is the intensity of our spectra as a function of energy and momentum. And we get these peaks, which in a sense are quite strange, as you will see. And this is the one quadrant of the brilliant zone, and this is the Fermi surface. So these are the occupied states, these are the empty states, and here we're crossing the Fermi surface along the nodal direction, that means along the diagonal to the copper-oxygen bonds, which are oriented along these directions. Now, we have shown that, in fact, what ARPIS measures is the spectral function times the Fermi function, and of course, this was known already, times the matrix element, which is just the probability of taking an electron from an occupied state to an unoccupied state via the dipole matrix element. Now, the interesting part here is that this thing depends mostly on momentum, the polarization of the photon and the energy, and some selection rules regarding the symmetry of this operation. While the spectral function is what really concerns us today, and that depends, of course, also on K, on the frequency, on the initial, on the energy of the electron, and on the temperature. And there are some rules that control this, which is what allows us to show that, in fact, we are measuring the spectral function. Now, there's two ways to look at this spectral function. One of them is to fix K and look as a function of energy. That's the traditional way that it's done in photon emission, and you get these broad peaks, which we call energy distribution function curves, simply because it's energy as a function of it's the intensity as a function of energy for fixed K. Now we're going to be looking at a very small energy scale here. So normally, if this was a large energy scale, the reason this is not the reason this is called an energy distribution curve is because, in fact, momentum varies along here. But for such a small energy scale, the variation in momentum is very, very small. So we can consider this to be a fixed momentum. The other way to analyze these is to look at the, this was first done by Philippe Abbey, or maybe even earlier by Franz Himsel and collaborators, and Lou Terminell and so on, long time ago, then more recently by Peter Johnson. But anyway, it's to look at, instead of fixing K and as a function of omega, is to look at it at fixed omega as a function of K. So this is, in fact, the spectral function at fixed energy, at the Fermi energy, as a function of momentum. Now, the first thing you notice is that, in fact, these peaks are very sharp compared to these peaks. And these peaks are really good Lorentzians, as I will show you. Okay, so the first thing that we can conclude from this, which is really quite strange in a sense, is that momentum is a good quantum number, okay? We have very sharp distribution, very sharp spectral function in momentum space, but energy is not, okay? This is a very broad, incoherent spectral function. So this is really already something unusual.
So what's the appropriate scale here for judging what's more and what's now?
Well, the appropriate scale would be the Fermi velocity. I'll show you later. Well, this basically the scale more or less times a constant of order unity, I guess. Right? Is that right? Something like, I don't know. It's a Fermi velocity, but okay, I'll show you. Just a moment. Okay. Okay, but the important point here, as we showed in a paper later, I'll show you which one, is that it's best to look at the momentum distribution to think about properties of the self-energy, the imaginary part of the self-energy, because this is a well-defined Lorentzian, and we can understand that. Well, this thing, we don't really know what describes this spectral function. Okay. Now, the interesting part is here you have the bare velocity, and in principle, the bare velocity is a real problem, but as I will show you, we're lucky to actually be able to determine this from the experiment itself. So in a sense, we can really say a lot about this quantity here. Okay, so let's look at this MDC. You can see here it is as a function of energy away from the Fermi energy. And these are just some of the curves. This is a wide range of curves, but here I've just extracted a few so you can see. And in fact, it's almost impossible to separate the data from the actual fit. It's so accurate, so it's really quite nice. But just in case, we cannot apply this indiscriminately. We have to be careful about it. But we do have a procedure for doing that. Because you see, the momentum distribution function is nothing but the spectral function at constant energy, right? So remember, I showed you that this was the photoemission intensity. Now, the matrix element for the small energy momentum range that we're looking at here, we can consider it fairly constant, as you will see. So if the matrix element is a slowly varying function of momentum within one MDC, within one of these curves, then you can just integrate this over k, and of course this is just one, so you just get a constant times the Fermi function. So if we were to integrate these and plot the integral of these as a function of energy, well, we just get the Fermi function, okay? So that allows us to check, in fact, self-consistently that we have done our job properly. But interestingly enough, in principle, actually that allows us to determine the temperature of the sample, because this is just a Fermi function. We could read it off this graph. Now, this doesn't always work. Sometimes this assumption that the matrix element is fairly constant doesn't work, and you cannot apply it indiscriminately. And here's an example where, in fact, you get nothing like a Fermi function, as this analysis presumes. And that's because there are very strong dependencies on momentum of the matrix element.
What's the possibility that sigma's capable of that causing trouble?
Well, you can just analyze that separately. Okay, this is the integral of sigma, but if you look at the momentum dependence of sigma here, there isn't any. I mean, it is a Lorentzian. Okay, that tells you that, you know, the generic form for a spectral function, this one, will only be a Lorentzian if sigma is k-independent.
Well, sigma has regular k-dependence, then it's just a normalized velocity.
Yes, right. So basically, it just comes from the fact that these are really nice Lorentzians and from here.
The assumption is that you can linearize the self-energy and also linearize the dispersion.
Right.
Those assumptions break down the floating point.
And that's precisely what happens here.
Well, 50 points are dangerous because of the saddle point and dispersion. They can be even careful.
Okay. So, So let's look at this and let's see if there's any energy dependence in this spectral function, which in a sense is what you were asking. So here's a spectral function, at high temperature, 95 Kelvin, and you can see it's a very broad, incoherent thing. And if I plot the width of this, if I plot the width of this thing as a function of energy, you see it's just a linear function. Just like you find in optics for the scattering rate, it's just a linear function. In fact, at higher energies here, it agrees quantitatively with the optical measurements. So there are no energy scales here. Okay, as I lower the temperature, this peak gets sharper and sharper, as you can see, but it's not moving. So where is the superconducting gap? Well, if you look at the Fermi distribution, which is here we're just plotting the Fermi function of just a non-superconducting material, usually we use gold or copper, you can see that, in fact, at high temperatures, the spectral function is completely controlled by the Fermi function here, while at low temperatures, of course, the Fermi function is sharp, so it has a more intrinsic shape. So if you really want to see what's going on, you really have to divide by this Fermi function, which is messing things up here, and then you get a clear picture. At high temperatures, you get a spectral function which is very broad, centered at omega equals zero, and as you lower the temperature, two things happen. The peak of the spectral function moves to an energy which is the superconducting gap, and you get a very sharp, drastic sharpening of the spectral function. So if I now plot the width dependence, you can see, in fact, there is an energy scale, and it's related to TC. Okay, so there's a drastic drop in the scattering rate, as we've known from the very beginning. Or it's true in any super, it's certainly true in these materials, actually. Okay.
Can I ask about the red line? Is
yes?
The red line such that I see it's linear with frequency?
Yeah.
Does it have any constant or impurity?
Yes, it has a constant, okay? So I will discuss that in detail. I will look at that in detail, okay? All right. Because you see, this is really not the best way. I just told you that the energy distribution curve is not the best way to look at this. Okay? Just to drive the point home right now. Now let's look at an underdoped sample. That means where we're less than optimally doped. Okay, about half the carriers that we've had in this sample. And then the situation is dramatically different. So at high temperatures, we have this so-called strange metal. So this incoherent spectral function just chopped off by a Fermi function, very broad. And as we lower the temperature, then we get a gap in the spectral, we get a spectral gap. We seem to have lost some states here. Okay, and so this region is called the pseudo-gap region. And then as we lower the temperature further, we start to get the coherent peaks of the superconducting state. And the gap has just gotten a little bit bigger. So in fact, this transition is not a mean field transition. There's something strange going on in between. And it's still a big question, what is that thing? What is the pseudo gap? What's its origin and so on? We're still actively pursuing that. And so is everybody else, I think. Okay, so now this pseudo gap is very strange, and I want to just show you this because it's very, I don't know how familiar you are but it's very unusual. So Mike actually came up with a trick called symmetrization. It's a quick and dirty way to look at what's happening. So if you plot your spectral function here, okay, and then you invert it, turn it around so that omega goes to minus omega, okay, you get that. But because the Fermi function transforms like this, you see, if you add those two, you just directly get the spectral function. Well, of course, you can't trust it to very high energies here, but at least within a certain energy range, it's okay. And we know that in the superconducting state, certainly, probably still, even in the pseudo-gap state, we can show that that's true. But we also know from tunneling, of course, because they actually directly measure the filled and empty state. and you can see that there's clearly, this is a sample which is underdosed all the way to zero, and you can see that in fact, there's some signature of particle hole mixing in, even in the most underdosed sample, or I don't know what else to call it, okay? But certainly this is symmetric. Let's call it particle hole symmetric, okay? That's the right, probably the right nomenclature. Okay, so we're justified to do that, at least within a certain energy range. But we're not going to make too much of this shape. Mostly, we want to know if this thing is gapless or not. That's really its use. And for that, we in fact don't even require this condition. Okay, so let's look at what happens then in this pseudogap region. So here I am at the antinode. That means this is the highest gap region, okay, where the gap is the largest. This is the diagonal direction to the copper oxygen plane, where the gap is zero. And if I look then at low temperatures, you have the superconducting gap, okay? And again, the symmetrized data looks just like tunneling. And then as you raise the temperature, something strange happens. Namely, the gap just fills in, okay? If we define the gap as the peak in the spectral function, I don't know what better definition there is for it, then you see the gap is actually not closing, it's just filling in. Okay, so it's really unusual in many ways. But if you go to some other part of the Fermi surface, like here, closer to the node, then you find that in fact the gap closes. Okay, so it's drastic behavior of this pseudo gap along this Fermi surface. And I'll show you just how drastic it gets. So anyway, Mike did some fits here to try to, just using some simple phenomenological models, which you might expect to fit to work within this gap region. They don't work outside, obviously, because he didn't put momentum dependence, I think. But nonetheless, you can see the drastic behavior in the gap in these two regions. But then let me show you what happens, really. What happens is that deep in the superconducting state, you have these nodes, right? Points of gapless excitations of this V-wave superconductor. And as you raise the temperature, you start to get these arcs of gapless excitations. So these arcs start to appear. And of course, we don't understand that at all. But you can imagine that this is sort of qualitative picture, if you like, a cartoon, that at high temperatures you have gapless excitations just where you have the Fermi surface, which is, that's easy to see, I showed you already, and as you lower the temperature, parts of the Fermi surface get eaten up, and more of it is eaten up until you just end up with the nodes of the D-wave superconductor. Okay, and we have some new data to look in detail at the momentum dependence of this, and I'll show you just how dramatic it is. So here it is. We're now doing this with very high momentum resolution, and you can see this is the nodal point here, and you see it's just totally gapless. And then all of a sudden, bang, a gap. Okay? So, and this gap doesn't really change very much, very little. Okay, so you can see that, in fact, it's just an arc, a gapless arc of gapless excitations here. Now, whether this is certainly not a hole pocket in the conventional sense, whether it's a hole pocket which is similar to a constant contour in a D-wave superconductor, it remains to be seen, but it certainly is not just a regular hole pocket.
Jesse?
Yes?
Do you have enough data to plot doping dependence of the width of this region?
We have done this experiment with three dopings, I think, but we haven't analyzed it in detail yet. But it is something that deserves a lot more attention, obviously. Okay, so let me show you this arc. You can just image it, okay? And there it is at 0 millivolts, at 12 millivolts, at 24 millivolts, it's not doing anything. At 36 millivolts, and all of a sudden, once you go above the pseudo gap energy, then you get these hot spots here, okay? That means there's some signature magnetic scattering going on, but only at the pseudo gap energy. But it lights up like a beacon there. Okay, so if I was pretentious, I would ask if this was a new state of matter, but I'm not. Sorry, what?
The hotspot there, exactly at the magnetic
temperature. Yeah. they aren't. Okay. Okay, what about the evolution with doping? So let's look at, again, the overdose sample. You remember I showed you just one peak. Now there is one peak. There's no evidence whatsoever of there being more than one peak. But as we pointed out from the very beginning, if you do a Luffinger count, that means that, if you believe in such a thing, that there must be two degenerate copper-oxygen states, because otherwise you couldn't account for the doping of this material. If you do, it agrees sort of very accurately with what titration experiments or whatever find. So that was our conclusion. Now, later it was found by, so we concluded that there must be two degenerate Fermi sheets in this case. In other words, this is very strange because the copper-copper distance in the plane where all the action takes place is almost the same as the copper-copper distance perpendicular to the plane. Okay? And why is it that you have very strong interactions or, you know, dispersion along the plane, but there's nothing perpendicular to the planes, no interaction whatsoever? Okay. So clearly this is a very incoherent, strange state. One simple way for us experimentalists to think about it is that the electron doesn't have enough time to hop up and down coherently to couple these two things. Okay, however, if you go to an overdope region, then you see the splitting. This was seen first by Shen's group and Dessau's group. And then it's just more conventional. You can really see the splitting of these two states. Okay, they don't split along the node. That's because of matrix elements. Well, yeah, they can't couple along that direction, but they can couple maximally along this direction. So they split in a well-defined fashion. Okay, and you can see this is a cut in energy. You can see this is a cut in momentum. You can see the two bands quite nicely. Now the question is then, how does the system evolve from a completely incoherent state to a apparently coherent state? It's really metallic behavior in a sense. This is not so strange, other than the fact that there's a stronger normalization here compared to the band structure numbers. It's still a metallic-like behavior. Okay, so the question is the following. Is there a continuous evolution between the strange metal and the Fermi liquid? Is it just a tuning of parameters, as it were? Or really, is there a crossover between the two? What is the difference? Okay, day and night is a crossover. It's pretty drastic. So I don't know what the difference is other than it's detectable over a very small temperature range. That's the difference. So, you know.
I mean, how sharp is the crossover?
It's sharp. Well, in temperature, it's relatively sharp. Sharp enough to define it in some way. Well, I'll show you, okay? So here it is. So this is an overdope sample, and you can see the two bands. And now, of course, it's not completely clear because of this Fermi function again, so let's just divide by the Fermi function. That's all we did here, nothing magic about it. And then you can see very clearly what's going on. This is the bonding band, the anti-bonding band, right? So now let's raise the temperature. So there you have the two of these. And then you increase the temperature, and lo and behold, you see what's happening. This antibonding bond has just disappeared. It's just vanished, okay? And you just end up with one broad coherent state, which is at the same energy as the antibonding, as the bonding state. Okay, so let's look at a spectrum along zero momentum here, along the bond direction. And you can see then at 100 Kelvin, you have these two peaks due to these two peaks here, the bonding and antibonding peak. And as you increase the temperature, they just disappear. And then it's fairly sharp, okay? And then they forever disappear. And in fact, then the spectral function doesn't change anymore, as far as we can tell. It just remains more or less, well, for this energy range that we probe, more or less independent of temperature. So one way to look at this, we're probing two things here. The fact that we have a sharp peak probes the in-plane coherence of the electrons, and the fact that we have two peaks probes the out-of-plane coherence. And you can see they're both really disappearing at the same energy, at the same temperature.
Yeah.
Okay? And more importantly, this temperature, of course, depends on doping. So that's what allows you to draw a line here, because you can just vary the doping and see how this changes. Now, you might ask, well, isn't this just a temperature effect? Well, it could be, except that the width is changing by more than an order of magnitude. The temperature is only changing by a factor of 3. Still, here is more evidence. So if you plot all of these just together, you can see that it's not that they're getting broader, not at all. They're both just disappearing at the same time. They don't really get broader because this width is already bigger than the temperature. Okay? So it doesn't make sense for it to depend on temperature in that way. They both just disappear. But still, you might ask, is this really some crossover or is it just temperature? Well, we can look at this a little bit more carefully. So again, what I'm plotting here is a constant energy curve as a function of momentum here crossing these states. And you can see there they are. Okay, it's a little noisy, but you can see all of those. Then as you increase the temperature to this incoherent state, look what's happened. These have just disappeared. As I showed you in the picture, these are gone. Okay, and then you raise the temperature again, and lo and behold, there they are, back again. So this is the superconducting state, this is the incoherent state, and this is the normal state. Okay. Right, but we can do better than that, because we can look at the momentum distribution. Remember that if we integrate the spectral function with energy, we just get n of k. So we just integrate the beta along the energy axis and plot it as a function of momentum. And here it is, that's the momentum distribution, right, along here. Okay, now let's raise the temperature. Look what happens. Actually, the width of this thing has changed. Okay? It's become much broader. The area is conserved, but the width is bigger. And then when you go down in temperature, you recover what you had before. So this is not some kind of aging, and it's certainly not just a conventional Fermi function story. It cannot be. Okay? So it's definitely not a temperature effect. The only way you can get this to happen, as you probably all know, is just it has to become incoherent. It's so strongly interacting that the momentum distribution just does something completely different. Actually, there's a precedent for that, and this is projected wave function work of Paramikanti et al. So on where, in fact, they showed that along the nodal direction, you have nice discontinuities, but if you look along the antinodal direction here, this distribution is even broader than you would get in a BCS case. Well, that's certainly the case here. So this is not even a BCS-like broadening. So we're quite sure at this point that, in fact, there is this drastic change from a Fermi liquid state to a completely incoherent state. It's not a minor effect. I'll show you some more evidence. So as a result, if we do this as a function of doping, we conclude that we have to add a new line to the phase diagram, which separates the metal rather drastically from the strange metal. Okay. All right, so let's look at this a bit more carefully. So now let's look at the whole phase diagram according to what we see. So again, if we drop the temperature in a sort of more or less optimally doped sample, in the strange metal case, we see this gapless excitations out here, okay, which trace the Fermi surface of the material. And then as we go into the pseudo-gap state, a lot of that spectral density gets eaten out by the pseudo-gap. And then as you lower the temperature further, then you get the superconducting state. Okay. Now let's look at it for an overdose sample. And again, if I look at high temperatures, you see above this crossover line, you see a curve that looks very similar to that. I'll show you in a minute just how similar it is. And then as you lower the temperature to the metallic state, lo and behold, out pop the quasi-particles. They show up like a sore thumb. And then you go into the superconducting state and you just get back the, well, this looks very similar to that. Smaller gap, of course, but a mighty big thing. Okay, so let's compare then this spectral function to that spectral function. Those two. They're identical. So this is really unusual. So in this energy, in this range, okay, for this range of temperatures, the material doesn't care what, even what its doping is, I guess, as far as I can tell. It just looks the same. It doesn't seem to even care what the temperature is, apparently. So, it, because again, this width is just so many times the temperature that I don't think it is has anything to do with temperature, simply just incoherent state controlled by something else. Okay. And then you see the difference. So I'm comparing those two. Now let's compare those two. They couldn't be more, they couldn't be further apart from each other. But again, all that's happening is that over this narrow energy range, in this case, you either have a pseudo gap here or quasi particles there. But at higher energies, again, not much is happening. Okay? All the action is always, as far as we can tell, in a small energy range. Of the order of the pseudo gap energy or the superconducting gap energy. Okay? All right. So to look at more detail and answer Doug's question, here it is. So if we now take a sample here.
Can I ask a question? Yes? The previous data were all close to 0.5 point, as far as I understand.
This is at the zero.
Yeah.
No, it's otherwise at the antinode, sorry. At the antinode. The 0.5 point is well below the term.
Close to antinode, which
yeah.
What happens if you consider nodal direction? Do it have the same crossover line, or it will be shifted?
Along the nodal direction,
mm-hmm.
You know what? We haven't done the experiment. Okay. All right, sorry. Not yet, anyway. So here's a more detailed look. So here's what happens to the spectral function at this point here. So you can see this. These are the MDCs. That means the momentum distribution curves, beautiful Lorentzians. And if you look at this in detail, you find that this can just be described by A plus B omega, okay? So where the B is in fact angle independent along the Fermi surface, and the A is what changes, but it just changes like the pseudo gap. So this is the value this is the pseudo gap value, the midpoint shift of the spectral function as you move around from the nodal direction to the antinodal direction, okay, from the diagonal to the copper oxygen bonds to the copper oxygen bond direction. And so the gap, of course, sets in. Okay, here we have the arc, and then you have the pseudo gap. And then this B is just invariant, and A, this term, is just follows this function. And Mike has an argument why it should be so. Okay. Now you can do very detailed fits. Adam has done incredibly detailed fits. You can see some of them here, but basically using one set of parameters, okay, you fit the whole spectral, the whole brillion zone in a sense. So you don't have freedom to change things as you see fit. Everything is sort of, to a certain accuracy, fairly well determined. And here's what you get. You get an imaginary part of the self-energy, again, which has no energy scale. Okay, it's just linear. And then the real part does something like that. And as you move from the node to the antinode, these look the same, they just sort of split apart a little bit more just because of this turn here. Okay, so that's a summary. There are no energy scales so far, only in the superconducting state. And of course in the Fermi liquid state as well, but okay, now I promise you that we could actually determine the bare velocity fairly, just experimentally. And that's because certainly the width of the momentum distribution is given by this function. And we know now that the width of the momentum distribution is linear in omega. That's another experimental result. And we know that the self-energy evolves like that. So simply the Fermi velocity is just this coefficient divided by that coefficient. Okay. So that means that this is the actual Fermi velocity. The red points are corrected for some experimental conditions, but basically it's constant along the Fermi surface. And the bare velocity just more or less follows the band structure prediction, if you like, as far as you can tell. Okay? All right. So now let's look at the spectral function anisotropy with doping, which I guess I was asked earlier. So let's look at three samples, an underdoped 78 Kelvin, optimally doped 90 Kelvin, and overdoped 80 Kelvin. So at 100 Kelvin, they're anisotropic in the sense, yeah, if you look along the node and the antinode, they don't look the same. And that's because, of course, here there's a pseudo gap. Okay. Now here, there's still a pseudo gap actually, so the two are not the same. But at 100 Kelvin, if you look in the Fermi liquid regime, they are the same. Okay, that was found earlier already by Volgano et al. Okay, so the question is this just due to the pseudo gap, or is it something else? I'm not so sure it's just due to the pseudo gap, as I will show you. Because we can look at 250 Kelvin. And again, here, this is just a pseudo gap. It's nothing new. Here is not the pseudo gap. Okay? But those two are actually gapless. I will explain in a minute why. And here is in the overdose sample at high temperatures. And they're still anisotropic. Okay? So, there they are. Okay, so you see, this is not really, this is gapless, although it doesn't look like it, because this is a sharper peak so that it crosses the Fermi energy at higher up. It doesn't cross near the middle. That just has to do with it. In the limit of a delta function, of course, the peak is exactly at zero. So it's just a simple way to see that the sharper the peak, the higher up its crossing value. But we can determine that independently anyway, experimentally. So this is not gapless. This is gap. This has a gap. This is gapless. This has a gap. And this is anisotropic. So this is some kind of an accidental isotropy, really. Even this anisotropy is even present in the superconducting state. Okay? And here you can see. It's very, very anisotropic, right? But the spectral weights are the same in the superconducting state. And the superconducting state is really not very unusual, other than at high energies, things are pretty wonky, but the spectral weights are the same, independent of where you're looking at, independent of doping. Everything is conserved. Okay, so to summarize then, what we find is that the spectral function is linear over a very wide range of the phase diagram. It's linear in energy, and we haven't actually checked temperature, but other people have, over limited parts of the phase diagram of this area. But the energy dependence certainly looks like that. It has quasi-particles in this part of the phase diagram. Okay. But it's really anisotropic everywhere except in this region here. As you would expect, really, from a D-wave superconductor. There's no reason why it should be so isotropic. I finished very early. Thank you for your attention. Yes?
Yeah? Can you determine with the same accuracy what sigma double prime does in this green region?
In the what?
Green region, antinodal quasi-particles.
It's been done already by Johnson and collaborators.
Right, but do you have your own data? And do you have the same analysis with which you determined linear?
Yeah, we have data, but we haven't looked at it.
The question is, of course, whether you can get omega square behavior.
Oh, I see.
Exactly the same feats as you did.
Oh, okay. All right. Here we're at odds with some people, but if we take Alain Raffi's samples, which are quite nice as far as we can tell, and we plot the derivative of the resistivity with energy, with the derivative of the resistivity with temperature, you get two regions. You get a flat region at higher temperatures up here, and you get a quadratic part here. I mean, it's not the whole story, because if you try to fit the thing as some sub, I mean, it's less than two, greater than one. But if you take the derivative, there's a change, which is quite, in our data, fairly clear.
So the t dependence of A is not linear, it's something else, it's more like a constant, or?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I, the t dependence of A. Yeah, I guess, no, it is, well, here in this region here.
Yeah.
So here it's linear, I guess.
Here.
Yeah, here, I guess not. Yeah.
As well as probably B.
What?
As well as probably omega term. Also doesn't remain linear and omega in there.
I mean, I don't know the answer to that. No, the omega term, well, I don't know the answer to that yet. Okay? I don't.
Johnson claims a T squared behavior in this regime.
Right. The question asks, there was a pretty detailed analysis done in a region labeled as nodal. I'm wondering whether exactly the same analysis can be done in another region to see what the difference is.
Well, we haven't done it, that's all I can tell you. Okay. Yes?
So, I want to be in the superconducting state.
Yes.
And somehow, I'm going to be antinodal or nodal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that sigma double prime doesn't show an omega cube dependence at low temperatures.
Oh, I'm not so sure that's... Omega has a... What do you mean?
I was thinking that somehow the phase space, the D-wave superconductor, would somehow make the sigma double prime exhibit an omega cube dependence. And as you know, that's seen rather nicely in some of the, if you try and fit some of the Doug Bond's microwave data.
Right. Oh, yeah, there's, sorry.
Do you see something?
We see a very large change in the omega dependence in the superconducting state along the node and the antinode. At the antinode, it drops. I mean, it really, the scattering rate just drops like very drastically.
Yeah, but the question is about nodal direction.
No, in the nodal direction, it drops less drastically, maybe cubed. I don't know, was it cubed or?
Should be cubed. You can fit the cubed if you take into account the resolution offset.
Right.
One of the problems is that even in the superconducting phase, they always have some finite width of the Fermi energy, and this is simply because of resolution.
K resolution?
Well, both K and energy resolution.
Yeah. Both K and energy.
Yeah, we don't have that data with the new resolution now. We should try again.
Yeah, but going back to what Doug, there was earlier Johnson data, who claims that this linear behavior extends into superconducting state.
I don't have to even think about it. I mean, do you? In the superconducting state, there's an energy scale, there's a symmetry breaking. How can it be?
The data.
I mean,
The question is about the data.
He retracted it. He retracted it now.
No.
Let's
be careful here. What Johnson said was that the linear T behavior, JC has been talking about omega behavior. Johnson was claiming linear T behavior persisted below TC, but now he's retracted this recently. He claims that there's a super linear behavior.
Okay, great.
It can't be, Andre. It just can't.
No. I'm not defending you.
Most people here agree with you. But many meetings we've been beat upon by the fact that data is not showing this T cubed or omega cubed or whatever. But you aren't doing that to us.
No, I'm not doing that to you. I mean, we've done that experiment. I can show you, but it just can't be. I mean, it's.
We agree.
Okay. So I can show it to you if you have a little bit of patience. But we have that paper here. I'll show it to you right now. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so resolution will always make it look quadratic about zero frequency. We call it a resolution.
Okay,
but
so
is there any way to drop in sigma double prime once you go below TC? Take a fixed frequency and just plot it as a function of temperature. Is there a drop at TC?
This is the whole point. So no one had seen this before, but now Johnson's claimed recently that he's seen this drop in temperature as you go below TC.
It has to. I mean, look at the resistivity. The thing is a superconductor. I don't know what to say. You know? Okay, so here it is.
I think one of the main issues is that oftentimes people do analysis without taking into account resolution. That's dangerous because it's significantly large, especially along the middle.
So how could you have a superconductor if it doesn't drop to zero? I mean, I don't get it.
No. For the nodal direction, it still has a function of, it's still finite at finite frequency. The issue is, it should be omega cube according to any calculation in D-wave.
Okay, here's our analysis, which I think we've done very, very carefully in great detail. And this is what we get. Here it is. So let me magnify this so you can see it. Here's what we find. Okay. So here's what happens to the spectral function along the nodal direction. All right. And there is no way, and you can see that from everybody's data. Okay. And so given that, you automatically cannot conclude that the thing is linear and it's just linear. It can't be. Okay. So in fact, when you do a careful analysis, so this is done with the EDC, as I said, this is not really the best way because there are renormalizations that we don't know anything about, like the energy dependence, momentum dependence of the, in the self-energy. But this is done with the EDC. So you can see there's a drop, and we're just, this is Q, but it's, we're just resolution limited here, so.
See, the drop in MBC looks less pronounced, and this is because the resolution affects the MBCs qualitatively more than it does the EDCs.
Yeah.
This is part of the problem.
But there are all kinds of things. If you look at the velocity also, you see that, it just, there's no way around that one.
What if we, wait, this is still on the board.
Yeah.
I think you said before, as you now try, as one goes out to higher energy.
Yes.
Fly, remember seeing earlier, showed somehow it continues to rise and then it kind of flattened off in one of your fits.
Well, eventually you get to the bottom of the band, right? So it's let's call it band, quote unquote.
Near the anode.
No, there's no evidence for this. The problem is the following. You cannot have a self-energy continually to rise, otherwise you violate Cramer's quantity relations. So what happens on the fit is they have it saturated high frequency so that they can have a proper Cramer's quantity.
So it
I showed you that before. I mean,
maybe put it in hand. Otherwise, there's no causality in the self-energy anymore.
Yeah.
I guess I wonder whether one has the ability to pull out structure indicating that this perhaps is cutting off, for example, at the top of the magnon band or something. Right? In other words, are we ever going to learn that? Learn something about the higher energy part of the imaginary part of the self-energy to try and let us know who's doing what to whom.
Okay. So this is what we get just from fitting the thing. Okay, I guess Adam did have to put in a cutoff.
The cutoff is a half a volt. See, the problem is by the time you get down to half a volt, everything's completely smeared out. You can't fit the data.
Yeah. It's horrible. I mean, I can show you the actual data.
Yeah? If you want to see. To me is it's still rising at, I don't know, 0.3 or something.
Yeah.
And somehow, if you really believe that, I don't remember where the neutron data, I know it goes to quite high energy, but it's cutting off at 2.5?
200.
So if you said, look, it's really spin fluctuations, and you then show that, it would suggest there's some other stuff out there that is playing a real role in damage.
There's no evidence in the optics for a cutoff either.
Mm-hmm. But also, question about the data. You see, cutoff here is about half a volt.
Yeah.
But I presume that the data will not take it up to half a volt. Or the
no, it was taken up to high energy. Yeah, but I'll show you the data. I actually have it somewhere. Where is it?
They made a cutoff at 300.
No, okay, maybe I'll show you something. I think it's this one. No. Okay, I can easily show you that. Give me just a second.
Here's the implication then that what's going on here are particle hole charge fluctuations or some channel different than the S equal 1 channel, which doesn't seem to have energies at that.
My big question whether really linearity extends up to half a volt or is just a little bit exaggeration of...
Well, suppose it extends up to 0.3.
So there's one issue. If you look at the spectral function, there's a minimum around half a volt. And then the thing, of course, starts to rise as you go towards the what you might want to call the lower Hubbard band or when you start using the main valence band. And there's obviously a tail coming off the main valence band, and then you get to this issue about multiple features of the data.
I mean, this is the actual data. This is in the superconducting state, so there's a break here due to the energy scale of the superconducting state.
Yeah, let's talk about that break.
Yeah, well, it certainly is there in the superconducting state.
But let's first answer this question about high frequency.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so anyway, you can see this thing is just so broad. I mean, that's the bottom, then it goes up the other side. But it's just...
Right, but at the same time, you show fits to the data. It shows linearity up to half a volt.
And well, but this is more than half a volt here. It's a, I don't know what it is exactly. Half a volt is about here or something. You can see it's just by eye. It's not very... If you imagine that in the normal state, this is straight here. It's just a straight line. I mean, oh, so that's a dispersion, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You can't see,
it's
but
not
if you even look at the width, it's not doing anything unusual.
Well,
over the energy range, they take data. The width just increases linearly with energy.
Yeah.
There's no evidence for saturation or anything.
Yeah. So
what about the kick? Can you comment at all as to what you believe it's due to?
Okay. So let's see. So in fact, this is our pink paper. well, what is it due to? That's a good question, and I can show you some data on private later, okay? Which you might find interesting. But okay, so what is it due to? What we find is in the normal state that we don't see much of a kink. All right, in the normal state, I mean, some of the data that you see in the literature is plotted in the pseudogap state. Of course, that will have some strange phenomena. Okay. So be careful, you know, ask the author, is this in the normal state or in the pseudogap state? If it's in the pseudogap state, all bets are off, okay? So in the normal state, when I call normal, gapless excitations, continuous Fermi surface, we don't see any signature of a kink. The kink comes in when things happen, when there's some energy scale coming into the problem, basically. And this is the effect. You see a renormalization of the spectral function, okay? And this equals kink. I mean, it's just, oh, in this paper, what we did is we actually, you know, did a Kramer-Schronig analysis, careful Kramer-Schronig analysis, to show that the two are, well, here it is, isn't it? I mean, actually here, you see, the dots are, one of these curves, I don't remember just now, but one of them is obtained from the actual just width of the curve, and the other one is obtained from the Kramer-Schronig of the real part of this. Okay, and because we're just looking at changes in the self energy, not the absolute value, we can look at this Kramer-Schronig exactly. We don't have to worry about parts that at higher energies. Okay, and this is quantitative. It's just quantitative agreement between dispersion and width. Causality works. So this is also proof that we're really measuring the spectral function. And so this energy scale, I mean this kink, is everywhere along the Brillouin zone. We have this always, although it's not always acknowledged, but it was there in this paper, that the fact that this energy scale is everywhere in the Brillouin zone as you go from one side to the other. So, you know, it appears when you see magnetic effects, we notice that, but I don't know if we can prove it. Okay, so that's as much as I can say.
But your former student, Dink, was saying that there is S-shaped dispersion if you go away from nodal direction and it ends up at the king. Do you see anything like
you
this?
You can see it right here. You know, there it is. I mean, that's basically an S-shaped dispersion.
And it disappears into kink when you go to nodal direction, right?
Then it's just a break instead of a... Yeah, it's like the effect gets larger and larger as you go this way. So, but is this right at the nodal direction? Is it just magnetic or not? I don't know. It might not be. I don't know. Well, we have some new data that we have to look at. It's just brand new from a few days ago. So, interesting.
Okay, that's it. Let's thank you.
Thank you very much.